This is your real estate syndication show. I'm your host, Whitney Sewell. Well, I have a very special guest for you again this week, a great friend of mine who I know you are going to be encouraged by in so many ways. He is a successful real estate developer, and actually he was in the retirement housing business and still is. But you know, there was a point in his real estate career where he made a midlife transition, and now he's helping and has helped thousands upon thousands of other business leaders do the same thing. You're going to hear a lot about that transition today, but ultimately how it can possibly help you as well. And I hope it does, as he asks some very critical questions that you need to ask and take the time to answer as well. His name is Lloyd Reeb. He's been doing this for over 30 years, helping people really transition what he calls their second half. That's not tied to an age either. It just, you know, it's a transition into something that I'll let him explain as we dive into it. But he's helped found the Halftime Institute, which you'll hear a little bit about as well. He was mentored by a guy named Bob Buford, who wrote the book Halftime, which I hope you have read. If not, I would highly encourage it. And I would also recommend Lloyd's book called A Success to Significance. Lloyd's been a friend of mine for a couple of years now, and has mentored me in a number of ways, from my faith to my family to business. And is just a man that I look up to greatly, and I'm honored to be able to share him with you today. Lloyd, I'm excited to have you on the show. I've enjoyed getting to know you over the last almost a year and a half to 2 years now, and just love what you represent and in ways you've helped me that I will be forever grateful. And I want to share you with the listeners today. So welcome to the show.
Oh, you bet. Thanks a bunch, Whitney. Looking forward to chatting and learning from each other. And I too have enjoyed being on this journey, watching you think through how you use your platform to, you know, make a difference in lots of people's lives, particularly kids that you care about that need a home. So love getting behind that dream. Every kid counts.
They do. They really do. So I appreciate that. And Lloyd, I just want the listeners to know, I want to jump into that. I love your take on your mission, your family, all that focus, because we can get so distracted, man, as business owners, right, as entrepreneurs, and we're very driven, and we see this dream over here in business, but man, family really goes by the wayside too often. And I feel like you've helped me and thousands of others, you know, to kind of recalibrate, right, and to have a plan, though, for that mission, that overall mission of what's truly important, and I want to get there. And before we do, you know, you have a long history in commercial real estate as well. I want you to be able to share with listeners and us kind of walk through your journey a little bit, but then I want to jump into that as well, this map, this roadmap, this way that you help so many and have helped so many. But speak to the listeners a little bit about your commercial real estate background, and, you know, what your focus was there, and we'll talk about kind of your transition.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've always loved real estate, Whitney. I bought my first piece of land in New Jersey near Atlantic City when I was 14, and my dad was my banker. He lent me, you know, thankfully he charged me interest. So I had to get out there and mow lawns and shovel snow, or, you know, I cleaned a Marshall's store all night long on Friday nights after school, you know, those kinds of things but it got me going. I remember walking out onto that piece of land and something deep inside me just exploded. It was in me, right? If you love real estate, you can't, you know, you can't avoid it. So I also loved the opportunity to scale, like to leverage, you know, in this case, my dad's money when I was, 14, 15, 16, and then I went off to McGill University in Montreal and married Linda. So again, because I was so focused on making money, I did a 4-year degree in 3 years, because just running the numbers, I realized I would make as much money in the 1 year I got out early to pay for all the three previous years. And then I started working at TD Bank. So I learned, and maybe many of your listeners, I learned early that I'm an entrepreneur. I am not a corporate guy. I was suffocating under layers of bureaucracy and slow moving and low ambition. And not everybody in corporate life is that way, obviously, but that's what I experienced, even in a great world-class bank. And so at 21, I bought 18 acres from Linda's dad. It was an orchard. It would be infill. The county had already told him that he couldn't get permission to develop it. But, you know, I could sever three lots across the front, save a 66-foot road allowance, and I used the money from the three lots at the front to pay for the design and start the construction of, you know, half a mile of road, and sold the lots off. And, you know, you're just dancing on the head of a needle trying to make that work as a 21, 22-year-old kid with no idea about curbs and gutters and roll curbs versus box curbs or that kind of stuff. I have pictures of our oldest boy, who's now 37, on this big dirt mover, you know, one Saturday, just, you know, and it was a fun adventure. It was huge risk. But again, if you're a real estate guy, you love that stuff, right? But that what's unique about some developers is they understand the compounding return on their, on what they earn. So when I cashed out of those 18 acres worth of lots, I didn't spend a penny of that money. I mean, I paid my taxes and then I didn't spend a penny. I drove an old beater to the bank. You know, it was so embarrassing when I pulled into the parking lot. You know, this muffler was bad. One day I was driving down the road, the keys fell out of the ignition. I realized I can throw the keys away. I don't need keys for this car. It starts without, it was just an old beater. But you know what? Every $1,000 I saved before I started developing retirement communities was going to compound. So then in 1988, my business partner and I built our first project. It was, you know, 60 units, roughly, independent care facility for seniors. We put roughly $1 million in and borrowed $3 million from, you know, the Bank of Montreal or Royal Bank of Canada. I mean, they were, who lends a 27-year-old, you know, $3 million basically? And we walked out of the bank that day thinking, these guys are crazy. You know, we barely have a license. So that was the start. And, you know, we still own that building and it's this many years later and it's paid itself off years and years ago. I love this business because not only does it go up in value, it pays itself off, but it's not sexy. And so it doesn't get you caught up in Ferrari driving necessarily. And little by little, you build compounding wealth. One of the most important things Linda and I decided early as real estate developers, we asked ourselves, in one word, what does money mean to us? Now, money can mean lifestyle. It can mean, you know, a claim. It can mean image. It can mean security. For us, we landed on freedom. And real estate is a powerful tool to have freedom to use your life however you want. And it's also a powerful tool to touch people's lives. Think about how many seniors have lived in our buildings all these 36 years since we started building them.
Wow. That's incredible, Lloyd. And just to back up there a little bit, why senior living?
Well, you know, I realized that I wanted, because freedom was the watchword for wealth in my heart, I was looking for a product that was stable, not too sexy, not likely to go through a major downturn, not susceptible to economic swings or even demographic swings. You know, there was going to be a rising tide of seniors. It was clear, it's just a pure demographic fact. And because we built right outside the city of Ottawa, which is the capital of Canada, most of our people are federal pensioners. Like, they work for the federal government and their income is dependent on the federal government's ability to pay a pension. And I thought, for goodness sakes, these are never going to be super sexy products, but they are never going to be, you know, go through a huge downturn. And so as a result, I can build my freedom around the cash flow coming from them. And they've literally been 97% full for all these years and provided us with complete freedom. Imagine, since 1993, I've had the ability to use 168 hours every week, however I want. And I love this business. So I love taking care of seniors. So in my mind, if you're going to develop real estate, get clear on why you're doing it. To what end was Drucker's question when he would talk to younger people like you and me. To what end? Why are you doing this? And then once you get clear on that, pick a product that really aligns with what your long-term desired results are. And then just become an expert at it. Really stick with it. And we know that space. I know how those people, the seniors, think. I know what they love, and as a result, we spent very little on, if anything, on marketing. They just have filled themselves up.
I want to. We're gonna. I know Linda's gonna come into play here a little bit as we talk about your process and commercial real estate and just the impact you've had on so many. But you mentioned you bought this property from her father. Were you all married then when that happened? I was just trying to think
Yeah.
the stresses on a marriage or maybe even a new marriage at the time when you all are. You talked about what would you say it's a huge risk, right? It's a fun adventure, but it may not have been as fun for her as it was for you. So I was just trying to, were you all married then and what did that look like?
Yeah, we got married at 20, 42 years ago. Linda doesn't like risk. Linda is not goal driven. She's relationship driven. And I don't know why she signed up for marrying me, but it was just like her dad was a principal. He walked to elementary school. He walked home for lunch. He walked back at 3:30. He drove a four-door sedan. She was used to stability. And then, oh my gosh, a whirlwind started. But she's been adaptable. So I just give her a huge amount of credit that she was willing to flex with that. And I told her, worst case, if it doesn't work, we'll own an 18-acre orchard and I'll work at the bank, miserably. But she went for it. And it was funny because many days I'd need someone to run over to a customer and get a deal signed. And I was at the bank downtown. So I would say, Linda, could you take this contract? And Carter, who was, this little diaper kid with spitting up milk. And I would send her to somebody's house to get a contract signed. And she was pregnant as well, I think. So, who doesn't sign a contract with a pregnant mom that's got a little baby on her arm? It's like, okay, I'll sign it and get out of here.
Won't delay her, right? Won't ask too many questions. That was wise, I guess, I think.
Yeah, but I do think it's important to be more sensitive than I was to how somebody at 20, you don't really understand how different people are. If you're married and you're taking big risks, then I think it's only fair that you talk it through. In fact, now when I coach people who are in midlife transition and have been successful in real estate, like me, they too are very often addicted to deals. And I ask them a really profound question. That I learned the hard way. In 2007, I was coaching a guy who had sold a bakery, largest bakery on the West Coast, for a couple hundred million dollars. And he bought into a big portfolio of C-class apartments, many in Phoenix and Scottsdale and Denver. And in 2007 is when he put 50 million of his own money, borrowed a ton of money, and they bought, $400 million worth of apartments. And 08 hit, and those apartments really suffered. But at the last minute, Lehman Brothers got him to sign a personal guarantee. I don't know why he did that, but then for the next 5 years, it just really ruined his life. Now, thankfully, he'd put a big chunk of his money in a charitable remainder trust, which couldn't get tackled. But I ask now the question, are you willing to risk your freedom and your wealth by signing, a guarantee of that kind in the future? And early on, you probably have to, but at some point, I got off all my guarantees after I turned 40 because I watched 9/11 happen. I saw the disruption that can happen in the world. And we paid a little higher interest rate, but once we got to 50% debt to equity, we were able to get off our guarantees. And I've never had any guarantees since then. I'm 62 now. So 20 years, let's say, of the only thing I'm signed, I've never had a mortgage on this house for 25 years. We paid cash for it. So I'm signed onto a little credit card, right? Which gets paid off every month. And guess what? No one can come knock at my door. So at some point in your career as a real estate developer, you really want to ask yourself, what does my spouse know about guarantees? And is she really or he really signed up for the kind of risks that come with huge guarantees?
You brought that up in a meeting that we had together. It made me even think about, does Chelsea, does she, my wife, does she know, even all the accounts and things like that, that, oh, if something happened to me, that, she wouldn't have a clue where to access those things, right? And it made me at least start having the conversations with her. I'm not as organized as you yet about this, but I am working towards this, but at least start having conversations about, different projects, you know, that obviously I'm signed on or not, or, you know, where accounts are and who you need to talk to, some things like that. But I want to document it. And I know, why don't you just mention that for a minute too, how you've done that, how really you've set Linda up for success. You know, in the unfortunate scenario that something happened to you, right? And I think that just kind of lowers the stress in that moment, right? As well. But, you know, maybe just highlight that a little bit, because I think it's so valuable that people are prepared. They're preparing their spouse for that.
So you may be married to someone who's very proficient at business and accounting and tax and doesn't need any kind of preparation or explanation. But if you're like me and Linda's not interested in that, she knows the people in the neighborhood, people at church, you know, all the sisters and brothers-in-laws in our family. She's loving people. She's not loving money. She uses money, but she loves people. And so I needed to think through how to really equip her in the case that I, you know, die suddenly of a heart attack or something. So several layers to it. First of all, I've thought through all of our investments from the simplicity standpoint. Is there any place where I could strip out complexity without really diminishing our return? Because sometimes you end up with a whole bunch of K-1s and you could have done it a different way and it wouldn't be so confusing and so time consuming. That's the first layer. Then secondly, documentation. Make sure that you have a black binder that everybody knows where it is. And, you know, it's got every asset listed in the front and all the asset access and all the passwords or whatever, however you're going to keep track of that. And then you need, you know, your will and your living power of attorney and your medical power of attorney and those things, so they're easy to access for her or him if something were to happen to you. And then what I've done is I've just put a cover letter on the front that's one page, that's our intent, our heart's longing for our family relative to the wealth we are entrusted with. You know, our basic belief is that we were given the ability to create wealth. And we're stewards of the wealth, that we really don't own it. And if we did own it, we'd own it for a very short time. And I think about Charlie Munger left this planet. And I think last I checked, he left every bit of his wealth behind. He was a steward of it for a season, right? And so I read that recent on the weekend to our daughter, Carolyn, who's in Germany with her husband. They've been married 2 years and we'd given them some money for a down payment on a house, and they wanted to talk through some of the things about money in a broader sense. And so we had an hour long conversation on Saturday, Whitney, and, you know, on Zoom, and I made the mistake of getting my black binder out from over here. And I read her that. I got about 2/3 of the way through and I was just crying, you know, because first of all, it's from my heart. And secondly, I'm just so grateful that I can share this with her now when she's 35 and really equip her to be a great investor and a great steward of wealth. So that's the second thing is, and then to have some people around Linda that really understand the complexities of our real estate business and the private equity stuff that we have in private debt. We have a couple of mortgages we hold on people's homes. You know, it's complicated. It's even trying to make it as simple as possible. It's complicated. So that I make sure that she knows personally and trusts the people who, like my business partner or like our financial advisor, that are aligned with her values. And then lastly, I've set it up that there's a certain amount of cash that just comes every month into her bank account that would cover her living expenses, so she'd never have to think about investments again. So suppose, you know, all those other things failed, she could just ignore our investments and let them compound, let my son and two daughters deal with it later and live off the cash that's just going to go into her account every month. And I think really the most loving thing I could do for Linda is not give her some extravagant gift that makes me look like a hero. It's to think about the little things that she's not thinking about that would make her life so much more comfortable in the event that I'm just gone, where I get no credit for it. I'm not around to get a pat on the back from anybody. So that's what I've worked on quietly. I really haven't, I mean, I've told her about this, but I haven't told her, hey, look at me. I'm looking out for your best interests. I think that's, you know, what you and I can learn together is how do we do this quietly and just really care for those we love?
Yeah, I love your focus on on Linda, right? And just how you have cared for her. I'm just learning from you and learning every time I'm with you. I feel like I'm pushed to do these things better and care for my wife better and family. And even your focus on how you were talking about helping your daughter, and her husband, and love that the time they are spent. And to transition here a little bit, I know. While you're still in commercial real estate, you've also taken on a bigger mission, I feel like, and a big focus, in kind of a different direction. I'd love for you to just speak about that transition a little bit, and maybe why, what prompted that, and the focus itself. I would love the listeners and us to dive in there a little bit.
I've had a mentor, actually, Whitney, every season of life. I had a mentor as a gymnast, which was different than my coach. He had been in the Olympics in Helsinki in the 50s, and so in the 70s, when I was doing, spending most of my time doing gymnastics, he was a mentor. And then in business, I had a mentor, a French Canadian guy that owned 27 retirement homes, and he just taught me by letting me wander around with him, right? And then I had a mentor in life named Bob Buford. But the powerful part was he was mentored by Peter Drucker. Peter Drucker is known as the father of modern management theory. And, he challenged Bob on a lot of different ways. And Bob Buford, my mentor, would pass those questions on to me. One of them I already mentioned already, to what end? He would ask, what to what end? But one of the things he wrote in 1989 to Bob Buford was, he said, "Bob, what you're working on in your life as a wealthy entrepreneur is an important new discipline. It's a new form of entrepreneurship. It's the entrepreneurship of your whole life, not just your capital. It's the innovative, creative use of your entire life to produce a product or a benefit that serves many, many other people, and brings you deep joy. It's using all of our entrepreneurial skills in a way that's bigger than just our capital and can produce actually a bigger compounding return on life." You remember when we first learned about compounding returns, maybe you were 20 years old or something in some finance class. I was mesmerized by the fact that it's just magic what happens. So now at this season of life, we know it at a very different level. When we were 20, we knew it intellectually. Now I know compounding wealth at a very deep heart level. I've watched it year over year magically compound. What Peter Drucker was in his 90s and he was pointing us to was this compounding return on life, that you can be an entrepreneur with your life and have a huge compounding impact that brings you more joy and blesses many, many people's lives. So one day my mentor took me aside when I was about 40, and he said to me, "Hey, Lloyd, I want to run something by you. I want you to take out a single sheet of paper, make two columns, and on one side, I want you to write down everything you have that's valuable." And I thought, like, this is going into an exam where you got all the answers. I'm going to kill it. So I'm writing down, this building, that building, this sailboat, and, cars or whatever. He said, "Good job. That's really good. That must bring you a lot of joy." But I should have been smart enough to know there was another shoe that was going to drop, And he said to me, "Okay, now on the other side, I want you to write down all the things you have that are priceless." And it just took the wind out of me. I thought, well, what do I have that's priceless? And well, maybe my business goes on it. And then I realized, no, it's got a value. That's what cap rates are. My business has a value, so it's not priceless. It's got a price. And there were very few things on the priceless list. And every one of our friends listening in would benefit from making the same list. And then he asked me, "Okay, good job. That's good. You've got a good list of things that are priceless to you. Now let's talk about what you're doing to protect them." And lo and behold, all the things on the valuable side were carefully and methodically protected. But most of the things on the priceless side were not. At the time, I wasn't paying too much attention to my health. My reputation was largely unprotected. I had no strategy to protect my reputation. My marriage, I was going along fine. We were 20 years into our marriage, but I really didn't have a strategy. It wasn't intentionally building into being the most intimate, deep, joy-filled relationship of my life. You go down through the whole list. Most of the things priceless to me were not seriously and systematically protected like the valuable things. So that forced me to stop and really think about what was the purpose of my life. Why was I building this wealth? To what end? And what was I going to do to really produce a compounding return on life, not just a compounding return on real estate? Now, the real estate turns out to be a great platform to produce a great life. But in and of itself, if all you do is just accumulate more and more, it's not going to deliver on its what you're looking for. And the story that made this most come alive to me was I was building a building in 1993, and my partner's job was to build them. My job was to fill them up and the design part and marketing. So I went to see a guy named Patrick Kelly. Patrick built the first indoor mall in the 50s in Canada. It was called the Eaton Centre, right downtown Toronto. Interestingly, it's since then been torn down. So if you think about legacy in real estate, every building you build eventually is going to be torn down, probably. So I went to see Patrick Kelly to try to convince him to move into our building. He was 78 years old at the time. And I went up to his big, beautiful brick home painted white with dark shutters and a big steps going up to the front door. And I'm 29 years old. And so he invited me in. The house was silent and showed me all around. And in every room, he had pictures of buildings he'd built, apartment buildings, the mall, the Eaton Center, high rise buildings. He's a well-known developer in Canada, a big fish in a small pond. I thought to myself, wow, if I stay with it, if I stay focused on developing real estate, I could end up like Patrick Kelly someday. And then the more I listened to his story, the more I realized the house was silent because, he and his wife weren't really that much in love anymore. He has almost no friends. Every one of those pictures on those walls filling up every room in that big house had no people in it. It was just pictures of buildings. And finally, I convinced him to move into our building, which was a win. But then walking out the front door, by the time I got to the bottom step, my mind had switched from, if I work hard and stay focused, I could end up like Patrick Kelly, to if I'm not careful, I just might end up like Patrick Kelly. And that was a huge turning point for me at 29 to see, hey, I want something more than just building wealth and building real estate. So I set out to figure out, how does a recovering real estate developer make a meaningful contribution in the world? So over these last, 30 years then, or 30, 31 years, I've had the privilege of teaming up with other talented people to make a really meaningful difference in other people's lives. And I love real estate, but I'll tell you, this brings more joy even.
Yeah, I feel like that, you're helping so many others, including myself, to not end up like Patrick Kelly. Right. I mean, it's because it's exactly what you just said. Like we all see somebody like that and think, man, if I could be like them, but you don't know those things. And I just think, what a blessing that you were invited that close to him where you could observe and see what you thought you wanted or what you learned you didn't want.
A little bit later when the building was nearing completion, he ended up in the hospital. He called me from his hospital bed and he said, Lloyd, two things. Number one, I'm not sure I'm going to come out of this hospital. My heart condition's really severe, but don't tell my wife because I don't want her to be worried. And by the way, those French doors in the blueprints that I signed off on, those French doors looking out over the river were supposed to be so many inches wide. And she tells me it's 6 inches shorter. You got to tell me. And he got really pissed off. And I said, juxtapose those two ideas. Like, think about that. I may not come out of here and I'm pissed off because you're sick. Well, I said, well, Patrick, look, let me go check it out and I'll give you a call back. Well, how the sliding glass doors come with bumpers on either side when they're shipped? They were 2-3 inch rubber bumpers on either side. I'm like, dude, you almost killed yourself in high blood pressure and torqued. I mean, your perspective on life is so freaking screwed up. And it was just a great model. I mean, I hate that he lived that life, but it just certainly saved me from doing that.
How you're helping so many to see that now, right? And to plan for a different goal, right? As we grow in our entrepreneurial ventures and what does that look like a little bit? Maybe some examples of people, that you've helped and some of the process.
So Bob Buford and I started the Halftime Institute in 1998 as a place where people could come, just like in football, into the locker room at some point in usually in midlife, when they've achieved some measure of success and they start wondering, for goodness sakes, is this all there is? Is this all there is? Just you accumulate money, you spend it, you travel, you buy a car collection. And then you get, old and sick and pass off. And could it be that life could be much more, enjoyable and rewarding? And what would give my next season even more joy, meaning, and impact than just Now, the interesting thing is real estate is a great platform where you can do both. So I wrote a book called From Success to Significance, when the pursuit of success is no longer enough. There comes a point when you have this burning discontent or smoldering discontent. You have everything that everybody else is longing for, but there's still something missing and you can't quite put your finger on it. And usually it's purpose. Now, I had dinner not long ago with the guy that, if you've seen the Netflix series, Blue Zones, on Blue Zones, areas of the world that where people live to 105. And he studied that over 25 years with the National Geographic study on areas where people have extraordinary longevity. And lo and behold, purpose is one of them. Purpose is like the second most important thing in life. It adds between 4 and 7 years to your longevity just by living with purpose. So it begs the question, what's your purpose or what is your mission statement? So Bob Buford and I started an organization that's grown around the world, and we help people get clear, get free, and get going. They get clear on who they are, their strengths, their passions, their purpose in life. They get free from the low-value stuff that's cluttering up their life, and they get going, testing out things they could do to make a difference. And many real estate developers find that it's right under their nose, that there are opportunities in every single building, for example, to make a difference in, what happens in one of your buildings when a woman is widowed? What happens? Who cares for her? I mean, the Bible's clear that the true religion is caring for the fatherless and the widows. Now, those are two categories you care deeply about, particularly those that are fatherless, little kids that for whatever reason don't have a mom or dad. You've got those people living in your buildings. And there are a lot of guys I've coached over the years through the Halftime Institute that have great real estate enterprises and use them as an important way of touching people's lives. There's the DLP, Don Wenner, that you and I both know, is a great example of that. He has, I don't know, 20,000 apartments and he's in his late 30s. And every one of those has a couple that lives in those premise on the property that's there to build community and help people get engaged, which increases their tenure at the building, but also to care for them emotionally, physically, spiritually, to be a care provider. And that's just one example. I'm coaching some guys that are building these outdoor resorts. And many outdoor resorts are places where people go and they could have a really life-changing camp type experience, or they could go and it could just be Margaritaville, where you drink too much and you goof off and you waste it. So they're building meaningful, family-oriented content around every one of their dream outdoor facilities that will be a great experience and shape families around harmony and deeper marriages and kids learning about values and all kinds of great things are adding right onto the side of what they're doing already. And then lastly, real estate can be something that you can be either more deeply involved or less deeply involved in. I've gained time back so I could do the Halftime Institute by paying my partner 5% of gross revenue, just a normal management fee way back when. I know that management fees have dropped since then, but you know what? If you have a partner that owns 50% of the buildings that is willing to manage them or some of them and give you some of your time back for 5% of gross revenue, it is the best investment. You get your life back, and then you can reinvest in something you care deeply about. So we have helped thousands of people around the world get clear on their purpose and build a roadmap around what they want in their life. And usually it includes their faith, it includes their family, their marriage, more intentionally investing in their kids, and really, for example, knowing their kids' strengths and love languages and what each kid's biggest risk is and biggest opportunity. And then around an area of purpose in their life, which of course are very diverse. You know, I'm coaching a guy now that's the chairman of International Justice Mission. They rescue thousands of young girls and women from sex trafficking all over the world. It's basically 400 lawyers taking down bad guys in places like Indonesia and Cambodia. I think about every day, if you woke up and your feet hit the ground, you know that you had a part to play in thousands of 12, 13-year-old girls that were being abused every night. Getting freedom from that? Do you think that'd be more fulfilling than another five-star cruise?
Or even building another building, right? Or closing another deal. There's no comparison whatsoever.
Yeah. And you know, the only thing I think back to the title of the book, From Success to Significance, is that it has a small but underhanded way of saying that you choose between success and significance, that you move, you leave behind success and you move to significance. Now, frankly, you know, it's been useful in hundreds of thousands of people's lives, but you know, the title's not exactly accurate because it could be infusing success with significance, infusing into your life of commercial success in real estate, something that's suits you, fits your strengths, and moves you deeply and blesses other people. I think of, you know, Jesus told a story way back when, a couple thousand years ago, a parable, which parable stories are great lessons, right? And he said, hey, don't be, you know, he looked at our life like soil. He said, your life is like soil and you get certain things planted into you. I was given, you know, great thinking from a dad that was an executive, and I learned about business from the time I was little. I was born in a family that gave me opportunity, obviously, right? I was given certain mental abilities. I was given a mentor, etc. These are all things in that were planted in my soil. Now, he said, you know, don't be the soil that's shallow and when tough times come, you know, nothing germinates. Don't be the one that gets all tangled up with weeds and get your life too complicated. I call it sloppy busy. I can't tell you how many executives I coach, they're sloppy busy. And in sloppy because they're doing stuff that they don't think really fits their purpose, but they're doing it out of obligation. They're on a bunch of boards. And don't be the person who gets enamored with wealth because it takes wings and flies away. But be the person who cultivates a good and noble heart and then listens deeply to what their calling is or mission, and then perseveres and produce 30, 60, or 100x return. So now I lead people on the pursuit of 100x return on life. In other words, if everything given to me, I took it and multiplied it, and it produced 100 times that in blessing in other people's lives, would I end up with more meaning, joy, and impact? Would I shape my family differently by modeling for them what it looks like to live a great life of purpose? So that's what, you know, I'm spending every day working on now, Whitney, with guys like you.
You know, you mentioned earlier, Lloyd, that you're often it's like right under your nose, your purpose or this thing, you know, that I feel like we're all seeking, right, in one form or another, but it seems so difficult to figure that out. But you say it's right under your nose. Maybe you give some tips on how you've helped people figure that out. And then you mentioned the roadmap. I'd love for you to highlight the roadmap a little bit. We're running short on time, but I want to go a little long here if you're able to, Lloyd. Because I'd love for you to be able to highlight the roadmap as well and help the listener to think through and how you lay some of that out so they can be thinking that way as well.
You know, the way you start to discover your purpose is, first of all, it's more akin to archaeology than architecture. You start by retracing your steps. When was I at my very best? When was I most at peace in life? You know, what were the circumstances of those two? What are the most painful things that I've experienced in life, and how have they shaped me? And so very often someone who's experienced a certain kind of pain in their life will find deep joy and passion around serving people in experiencing that very same thing. And so you could be as simple as getting a national newspaper every day for a week and reading it and simply asking yourself, what makes me mad, sad, and glad? What makes me mad, sad, and glad? And at the Halftime Institute, we have lots of different tools that we use to help people discover their passion. And then get clear on what you're good at. If you're a visionary, then that's probably what you're going to bring around that cause that you care about. But if you're more of an operator or an executor, then that's probably it. If you're a true entrepreneur, then don't join some big stodgy organization on a board. It's going to drive you crazy. Do something smaller. Look for entrepreneurial organizations that fit that.
But something I've appreciated that you've encouraged in so many ways is including our family, like you said, you know, like having your children to review it because they're learning at the same time, right? What's important to you. And I just love that and the conversations that's come out of that. I wouldn't say I've done that as well as with the kids, but a big part that you've encouraged is my wife, right? Like having her speak into this roadmap. Obviously, she's such a big part of that because what I'm focused on, you know, in those five areas affects her in a big way as well, right? And so I've just loved that. But the conversations that's come out of that, you ask about, you know, do you know your spouse's dream? And I remember when you posed that question, I'm like, probably not. You know, I'm guilty, right? I'm guilty. And so I remember going on some dates with Chelsea after that conversation about even just that one question and me posing that question, and it made her start to think, right? Well, she's thinking, do I know what my like real, you know, my dream is? What do I see myself, you know, doing 5 years from now, 10 years? What is this thing, you know, my purpose? And so it's just led to, it's a growing experience, right? Growing process for us as a couple and family, and even thinking through that roadmap. And what those areas of focus is. You mentioned one thing I wanted to mention before we unfortunately have to run, but is the board. You know, you said you have a board, you showed this to your board. How do you pick these board members? How many, you know, are they family members? Are they not? And how do you receive, you know, quality feedback, you know, from them?
Yeah. You know, it's not a weird idea. In fact, having a personal board, if you get the Wall Street Journal, every weekend edition has a segment, a section, a little article on someone's personal board of directors. It's easy to look over it, but look for it if you get the Wall Street Journal. So it's a simple idea that you have a few people around you who have permission to look into your life, not just for accountability, but to help you think ahead, help you see what you can't see, to identify your blind spots, and also to encourage you. So I pick people that love me, that bring different perspectives, that have the energy and time and inclination to give me thoughtful feedback. And then it's my job to go to them with enough information and systematically and request them, look it through, give me your feedback. They could be local people. They could be from all over, from your past. You can do it one-on-one or you can do them all together. You can do it once a quarter. You could do it once every 6 months. But and it doesn't have to be long and laborious, but you're opening yourself up to insights that you might not otherwise get. In fact, you probably won't otherwise get. When you go out to a cocktail party and someone gives you direct and informed feedback, you know, it just doesn't happen. You have to sit down with somebody and show them what's up in your life, what your fears and dreams and aspirations are, what's working, what's not working, and then ask them, please tell me what you see. Please tell me what's even hard for you to say and maybe awkward for me to hear. I always say to them, please tell me the last 10%. That's the part that's hard for them to say, but that's going to be most helpful to me. So to make it easy, I just say to them, please tell me the last 10%.
Love that. I think if we're all really honest, we don't always want that feedback, right? So we don't look for it hard enough. And just appreciate, again, your humility there to seek it out, right? And if we really want to grow, we need to seek it out, right? Those that will speak into us just like that. Lloyd, I'm so grateful for you, grateful for your time today, the interview. I know it's helped me and encourage the listeners in a big way. What's the best way for them to learn more about you, or maybe Ardent Mentoring, or you know, different things where you're contributing, where they may benefit?
Yeah, there's great tools they can look at and encouraging videos, et cetera, at halftime.org. And then if you love mentoring and you just don't know where to find a young entrepreneur to serve and inspire and equip, we make it really easy. Go to ardentmentoring.org, and we got great teams. They'll just help you get going.
Awesome. That's the end, Lloyd. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Whitney. Hope you have a great day, and be sure to set up some time for us to keep working on our plans together.
Yeah, I will. I appreciate you very much, Lloyd. Always a pleasure.